So my assignment is to discuss with you chapters 7 and 9. Compare? Whatever, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't quite sure anything more than that. Let us return to the beginning of chapter 7. I'll just go through this this chapter and point out certain salient features. Then we'll do 9. As we go to 9, we can look back at 7 because there are interesting similarities. Again, I want to point out to you that we see in the Bhagavad Gita how Krishna circles around and returns to the same topics over and over again. It's not a linear way of teaching. And every time he goes back around, you see he adds some more details, you see it from another angle, it's put in a different context. So gradually there's a build-up of knowledge and understanding by this One's first impression of the Bhagavad Gita was that it was hopped around all over the place. It wasn't orderly. The way we are taught how to do things is make an outline. Bhagavad Gita doesn't quite work that way. There's some stretches where it is very linear, but the structure of the whole seems at first to be chaotic. But after some acquaintance, you can see the method behind it. Now, if we begin chapter 7, there's a clear transition from chapter 6. First of all, this is the middle six chapters, beginning of the middle six chapters, which are the first six lead up to them. And especially if you pay attention to the the Sanskrit, actual devotional service to Krishna is rather implicit in the beginning. Prabhupada's translations and purports, you know, there's this phrase from Hollywood about movie making, cut to the chase. Get to the exciting part, the chase scene. I suppose that's what that means. Get to the exciting part, get to the point, get rid of all the other stuff. So in a sense, Prabhupada does this all along. He gets to the point of devotional service, and for his purposes, that was necessary, because the downside of the way the Bhagavad Gita is written, that a lot of people never get the point. It's gone out of the hands of teachers, and so people have managed to dump all kinds of things into the Bhagavad Gita, but they don't get the point. So Prabhupada wants to be certain of that. But now, having grasped it, now we can see how it actually proceeds. The sixth chapter is about yoga. And Krishna concludes, after discussing yoga, of course, that the highest of all yogis is the one who's related to me in devotional service, renders transcendental devotional service in faith. He's the Yuktattamaha. He's the most intimately connected with me. This is my judgment, Krishna says. So you notice there's a very clear transition. How by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, mad ashraya, or taking shelter of me. So now, okay, we've led up to that kind of yoga, of devotional service to Krishna. Now it's mentioned here. Now, Krishna is going to say, now by doing this yoga, and then he makes two very powerful claims. You can know me, asamshayam and samagram, without doubt, without any doubt, and completely. You can know me in full, free from doubt. Those are outrageous claims to make. But here's Krishna speaking, and this is what he states. So we should understand that these are not exaggerations. And so from this beginning of this chapter, we shall come to understand how this is possible. To know Krishna in full and also free from all doubts. Then we get to the second verse, which is equally outrageous. Now I shall declare unto you in full this knowledge. Remember the title of his knowledge of the absolute. And then we'll discuss this both phenomenal and numinous. I want to discuss, this is a little controversial because the first edition had a noumenal and this one has numinous. What he says, both jnana and vijnana. here the word jnana means phenomenal knowledge, which basically we can say, which can be perceived by the material senses, and numinous or noumenal, either way, which is cannot be perceived by the material senses. We'll leave. This being known, nothing further shall remain for you to know. So this goes on about the in full. And not only you should know everything material and spiritual. When I first read this, I thought, come on. How are you going to do this? Now I shall declare unto you. But actually Krishna doesn't. I've repented of that doubt. And we'll discuss how Krishna explains this thing. Now, the words here, these two words, jnana and vijnana, that are translated in this way, when, as you know, notoriously, because of politics, when the Bhagavad Gita was restored back to Prabhupada's original writing, it was in some ways de-edited. It was originally edited by Hayagriva and others, who took great liberties with the verses. He was given permission to do that. As far as the purports go, Prabhupada said not to change them, but there are many, many mistakes in the purports because Prabhupada was dictating, people were typing, they didn't understand what Prabhupada was saying. Many, many Sanskrit verses that Prabhupada either quoted or referred to, they didn't know what they were. They misunderstood Prabhupada's language. The famous, somewhere there's a planet of trees, where Prabhupada said pit trees, and so on. So, when people began to study the Bhagavad Gita a little more deeply in ISKCON, one kept running into problems. You saw the running translation, the one in bold blackface on the translation, and you looked at the word for word, and if you did, you couldn't figure out how you got one from the other. And the reason, it turns out, you couldn't figure out, and that led to doubts when people started to study it very carefully, instead of just, you know, memorizing the Sanskrit, memorizing English, and never try to put them together. When people started to study it carefully, they were baffled, and those people who began to study it were wondering what's going on. And but what happened is the word for word represented what Prabhupada said, but Hayagriva, wanting to make it mellifluous, literarily nice, with a free hand, I rewrote the translations. In many cases, he cribbed from other scholars and everything like that. But when one saw the original typescripts that were taken down from Prabhupada's dictation, his running translation rather carefully followed his word for word. And so that's why it was decided to go back to what Prabhupada had. Of course, still tried to make it grammatically correct and so on, but not alter it so much. So that's what really happened in this thing. And Jaya Dwaita undertook this because he was Prabhupada's editor for a long time, and he was always discontent with the way the Bhagavad Gita was. Some changes were made during Prabhupada's lifetime. Anyway, I was consulted by him whenever he had some questions, wanted to discuss some things. So this one came up, this phenomenal, and the original text said noumenal, N-O-U-M-I-N-A-L. N-O-U-M-E-N, excuse, M-E-N, and A-L. But when we looked at the typescript, Prabhupada had what in English literature is called a portmanteau word. This was invented by Lewis Carroll, author of Alice in Wonderland. You may have read a poem by him called Jabberwocky. 'Twas brillig and the slithy toves did mimble. You remember how it goes? He made up these words, which were portmanteau. Portmanteau is a satchel for carrying things, a hinged case. It means things are all jumbled up together. So he, when Lewis Carroll did this, like this word slithy or slithy, I don't know how you say it, slithy, he took the word life and slimy and added them together and made slithy. All mimsy were the verb, mimsy, flimsy, and miserable he put together. So this is called, after that, it's called a portmanteau word. So Prabhupada had a portmanteau word. I'm pretty sure he had the word noumenal. In other words, there's two words, N-O-U-M-I-N-A-L, noumenal, N-O-U with an O-U, and then numinous. The two words in English are noumenal and numinous, N-U-M, right? They have different meanings. And Prabhupada had the beginning of one and the end of the other. So we had to choose. Now, I'll just tell you the history of these words. This word, N-O-U, noumenal, it enters into the English language. It's a Greek word, coming from a Greek word meaning to apprehend or conceive. But it really comes from the philosophy of Immanuel Kant, the 18th century German philosopher, where he said that what we perceive with our senses of the world is the phenomenal world. You have these two contrasting terms, phenomena and noumena. There's the phenomenal world, which is what we see with our senses. But Kant tried to show that whatever we see, by the time our mind perceives things, it's already been massaged into shape by our own implicit structures. The concepts of time and space and other things like that is really our, we make a contribution. So that by the time you perceive something, it's been, I'd say the word massaged. Well, what is it, what is the world like before we perceive it? Or in itself, he used this term, the ding on zish, the thing in itself. That he gave the world word noumena, N-O-U-M-E-N-A, noumena, the thing in itself. And that is, strictly speaking, unknowable. You just cannot know it. And so it's simply described as noumena as a kind of a limiting concept. It just sets the border as a grenzbegriff. You just can't go any further. So it's very impersonal idea. Whereas as the other word, the N-U-N, I don't have a thing to write these up here. Numinous, N-U-M-I-N-O-U-S, comes from the Latin word numen, which means divinity. It's personal. Numinous refers to divine or spiritual, something that reveals or shows the presence of God. And it has also imparting a sense of awe and reverence. So numinous is personal, and noumenal is impersonal. So that's why we went with this one, because Prabhupada had both stuck together. And really, Prabhupada's word is a really great word. and what he really intended, that's what happened. Anyway, what Prabhupada means is both these, visible to our jnana here means the phenomenal world, and then the spirit behind it, and the source of both of them. This is transcendental knowledge. So this is everything. So the spirit behind it and the source of both. This is the noumenal or the noumenous. But it's certainly not, strictly speaking, unknowable, because we're going to know it. That's why we went with the noumenous anyway. So if you hear about this controversy, that's what happened. So he's going to say everything like this. And then Krishna goes on to point out how rare it is. This theme of hard to know or esoteric knowledge will be picked up again when we start to talk about, in the ninth chapter, that which is guhyam, guhyatamam, rajaguhyam, secret. Not everybody will know it. Of course, in the Bhagavad Gita, it becomes an open secret. But still, even so, people still don't know it. So out of many thousands of people, one may try siddha, for siddha, for perfection, for transcendence or liberation. And of those who have achieved this liberation or transcendence, hardly one knows me. And here's the word that we show up all the time, tattvataha, in truth, as I really am. So he wants to say, he points out here, how this is a very rare, difficult to understand. Now he proceeds, text 4 through 7, to give the inventory of everything that there is. He does this in just a few verses, and he actually describes everything. Now, this is a summary description. The details are left out. But first, he talks about the material elements in verse 4. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, manas, buddhi, ahankara. The five gross elements and the three subtle. Earth, water, fire, air, ether. Or as Bhaktisiddhanta rewrote it, to sound more up to date, solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, and space. See, right away, it's not archaic anymore, is it? same meaning. Solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, and space. So you grow in this list from the gross, that is to say the most perceivable, to the more difficult to perceive. Subtle space is hardly perceived at all, although it's not nothing. It has all kinds of properties according to physics. And then we go on to manas, buddhi, ahankara. The elements that make up the subtle body, the shukshma sharira. That's so difficult. People are not, some philosophers and scientists don't believe they exist. Anyway, they're hard to measure. The others you can express in terms of numbers, which is what material science does very well. It deals with the world as far as it can be expressed in terms of numbers. But beyond that, they have a hard time. So with manas, buddhi, ahankara, nobody's figured out how to quantify knowledge of these things. They can just try to deal with behavior. So anyway, he calls these my separated material energies. So in this inventory of reality, as far as phenomenal knowledge goes right now, only the first five of the separated material energies are really understood to some extent. Manas, buddhi, ahankara is still terra incognita, it's unknown land. Nobody has got any idea how in human beings the gross and the subtle bodies interact. It is, as far as we can see, a psychophysical unity. They interpenetrate each other. But how that, so they're part of the same causal nexus. How that works, nobody has yet figured it out. So, maybe people will start. I don't know, with all this modern brain imaging and stuff like that, they may start to figure it out. But until they actually have the right hypothesis to look for, that there's something else that we can maybe catch traces of, we can't measure directly, but there's kind of systematic unknown causes. Anyway, that's as far as they go. So that's the material elements, right? That's one thing. Now, besides these, O mighty armed Arjuna, there's another energy of mine which is superior, and which is made up of the host of jivas, jiva bhuta, who are exploiting the resources of the material energy. So they're the thing which is, phew, who knows about this? The souls. And of course this says that the souls which are from which consciousness and identity come from, are separate energy. It is not that consciousness arises out of matter or develops from matter. It's a separate energy. It is not that consciousness or motivation develops at a certain level of complexity of matter. That's always been an incoherent explanation. You have structures of matter which are expressible entirely in terms of numbers, exhaustively. These structures, over the course of time, for some unknown reason, get more and more complicated. And then at a certain level of complication, something entirely different pops into view, which is not just more structures of matter, more complicated structures of matter, but the experience of structures of matter. What is that? What's the causal relation? It's an anomaly. They're different, we would say in philosophy, different ontological categories.
Can you just explain that point again, this point you are making, that they're different?
Okay. The theory is that is prevailing now, because in the very beginning there are very simple structures of matter. Over the course of time, those structures of matter become more complicated. This is called evolution. You have subatomic particles. They become more complicated, enter into more complicated configurations. Then you get atoms. Then the atom configurations of the atoms become more complicated, and you get molecules. Then the molecules become more complicated, especially you get carbon molecules, and you get organic, big, fat, long, you know, amino acids and all those things like that. And then at a certain point of complication, you get life. And consciousness. By consciousness, we don't mean sophisticated human self-awareness. We just mean the ability to have experiences. That's certainly there in animals, and plants have it too, although people don't know. But anyway, to undergo experiences. So this is what happens. That certainly life and consciousness sort of develop along with this. But it's not just, so here's something new, the experience of structures of matter. How do you get from one to the other? So what Krishna is saying is you don't. And that his way of solving the problem, Krishna, it's not just a way of solving the problem, but what happens is there's two energies. One is this, and the other is the souls. And these two natures, they flow together. The confluence, like the Jamuna and the Ganga, merging together. And so all created beings have their source in these two natures. Actually, if you study the more detailed account of how they come together, one discovers from the story of the Sarga, There's two creations, Sarga and Visarga. Sarga is the creation of the material elements. Krishna lists eight here. Prabhupada explains in the purport how you can expand them into the 24. So it's just a summary way of... Those elements are created, it's clear from that account, they are from the very beginning, everything evolves out of false ego. False ego is the subtle, it goes from subtle to gross. This means that really the whole universe is created for the sake of the jivas. It's not that the jivas is some accidental afterthought. It's for the purpose of the jivas. So we can do our little thing. So these two things flow together, and Krishna says, of all that is material, and all that is spiritual in the world, know for certain that I am both the origin and the dissolution. Now, where do these two things that flow together? They come from Krishna. They come from him, they go out, and then they are wound up back into him. Bhava, he's the Prabhava, the source of manifestation, and Pralaya, the dissolution. And then, so there you see, here's matter, here's spirit, they come together, and then where do they come from? They come from Krishna, and then he says, Mata Paratanam Nanyat Kinchit Asti, and beyond me, there's nothing more to be known. There it is. And so this is Prabhupada's description. You may run into it many times. When Prabhupada says knowledge, he says it means what is matter, what is spirit, and what is the origin of both. Those three things constitute knowledge. So there Krishna's done it. By the time we get to the seventh or four to seventh, he's done it. He's explained everything there is to be known, knowing which you shall know nothing further, right? Questions so far about this? This is a simple but complete map of everything that there is. And it is useful for various purposes. For our purposes, this map allows us to see how do you get out. How is transcendence possible? Those maps which do not show everything, you cannot see. We looks like we come out of material nature. Like the scorpion eggs, the scorpions out of the rice, and there's no way of going back out. There's no way out. There's no exit. So that's one useful thing. The other thing is, if you take it seriously, even if you're a material researcher and use it as a guide, I think you'll lead you to many interesting discoveries. To have this as a guide means. You usually do not discover something unless you're looking for it. So you either have to have an intuition, maybe something's there, or otherwise you'll stumble right over and not recognize it. So this would be a useful guide, right? Okay, so now. We see in chapter 7, from text 8 through 11, we see something that occurs in chapter 7, chapter 9, chapter 10, in various ways, which is a kind of catalog or inventory of manifestations. It's typical what Krishna does after laying out a kind of general abstract outline of himself in relationship to his energies. He then gives a more concrete and poetic catalog of things. I am the taste of water. Now he's mentioned water. Oh, now I am the taste of water. This also you will know that each gross element like water and air, ether, they all have their tanmatra. There's first of all in the creation from subtle to gross. There, first of all, there's sound, the object of the sense of hearing, and just sound as such is called a tanmatra. Matra means merely that. And then that's from that sound, there develops the corresponding gross material element of space. And then there's a further development out of that. It's zapped by Krishna's energy. And then there's fire or luminosity. And then there's the corresponding gross things, which is the tanmatra is rather things like shape, color, and then it's fire. And objects of the sense of sight. And then with air, it's touch, objects of the sense of touch, and so on. So really the essence of water, the tanmatra of water is taste, and Krishna says, I am the taste of water. So this is a way, when he gives this catalog, how I am to be manifested here. So it's the essence of everything. Sun and the moon, well, light. The Vedic mantras, well, really what's the essence of it? The syllable Om. They all come, that's a bija. That's a seed from which the Vedic mantras, a sound comes out. I am sound in ether or space. And when he says ability in man, paurusham, a human being is a purusha, and so what Prabhupada translates as ability is paurusham, means really, it's almost tautological. It means purusha, when you strengthen the first syllable, it now means related to or derived from purusha. So what is very characteristic, defining characteristic of human beings? Their cleverness. they can do things. That's why it's ability. The element earth is distinguishing tanmatra, is fragrance. So I am the original fragrance of the earth. The fire is heat and so on. I'm the life of all that lives. In ascetics, what's the really defining essential characteristic? I am the tapa of the tasvinis. I'm the austerity of the ascetics. And then he summarizes, I am the original seed of all existence. So that's the point. Because all these things are like the seeds. It's the essential or defining characteristic of these things, out of which they their further manifestation is development. And then he says, the buddhi of those who possess buddhi, buddhi buddhi matam, and teja of tejisvanam, power of those who have any power. The strength of the strong, and he's also Kama. So then he summarizes, know that all states of being, goodness, passion, or ignorance, we're talking about the material elements, are manifest by my energy. I am in one sense everything, but again I'm independent. I'm not under the modes of nature, for they, on the contrary, are within me. So this is a very important statement, which will be made again and again in these chapters of the understanding of the relationship between Krishna and his energies, his material energies. He includes them, but he transcends them. And the main point is his sovereignty. He is not under the control of material nature. Material nature remains under his control. Even when he appears within material nature, it is not like us. We cannot, it's very difficult for us to imagine what it is like not being under the control of material nature. So our powers of action are very limited. Krishna's powers of action are unlimited. And ultimately, there's unlimited means no, there's no one controlling him. So this is what's meant by sovereignty. So through these chapters, part of the knowledge of Krishna is the understanding of Krishna's sovereignty, of his supremacy as the absolute truth. Which would, as we would say in theology, his transcendence. But you notice, at the same time, the opposite is always stated. His immanence, his presence here. Part of the reason of saying that I am the taste of water is that when you taste water, you should appreciate Krishna. That water wouldn't have the taste, the thirst-quenching potentiality if Krishna hadn't put it there. So Prabhupada comments that the devotee's reaction is to say, whenever we drink water, thank you, Krishna, for quenching my thirst. I have this thirst, I need this stuff, there it is, it works. How did that happen? It's a gift from Krishna. Everything we have to satisfy our needs is a gift from Krishna. And the proper response is to live with gratitude at every moment, not just say, hey, it's mine. So that's the point. So that in this way, even though Krishna is so immensely great and so immensely different from us, because we cannot conceive of his powers of action, nevertheless, he's present in so many ways. And of course, what develops in these chapters, last night we discussed the four essential verses in the 10th chapter, is that Krishna's presence to us is his personal availability to the devotees. Even though we're appreciating at the same time how great he is, we also have to appreciate how he's accessible to the point of extraordinary intimacy. So in many religious traditions, these opposites, they cannot understand how to reconcile them. But they are reconciled here in the Bhagavad Gita. It's always going to boggle the mind. That's okay. It's supposed to. If it doesn't boggle your mind, it's not God. So here in 12 we see this, how Krishna is above the modes. And then the next 13, now we go to those who do not know Krishna. Why? Because Krishna is above the modes and they are deluded by the modes. And then the famous 14th verse, now how can the devotees know Krishna? He's, I'm going to tell you how you can know me, right? In full and free from all doubt. These modes of mind, daivihyesha gunamayi, they're called divine energy. Gunamayi, made of the gunas, and it's daivi, means coming from deva. So he emphasizes, as we've been learning, that it's his energy, and therefore under his control. It is duratyaya. It is, you cannot cross beyond. Here are these people who don't know me, because they can't get out from under the modes. And then he says, mam eva ye prapadyante mayam etam tantite. But those who have surrendered unto me, they can cross over. So this word, prapadyante, they surrender. Now watch this, how this word shows up in this chapter. Because now it comes about who surrenders and who doesn't surrender. And who surrenders to the wrong things. Because as this is much as talking about knowledge, it's also talking about the idiots. The fools. Krishna uses some very strong language. Right? And there's a very interesting purport here in which Prabhupada explains how it works. How is it that we can cross beyond the material nature? Well, first of all, how is it that the souls which are described as superior are controlled by something inferior? Well, we're not really controlled by the inferior material nature. We're controlled by Krishna, who uses the material agency, the material nature, as his agent. So actually, it's Krishna who's controlling us through the tender mercies of the mother who devours her own children, Maya Devi. So we are under her control. And what happens is, one surrenders to Krishna, Krishna says to material nature, let him go. And that's how it happens. We can't say to material nature, let me go. But when Krishna says, then it happens. So how that works is explained here. So he describes here that those who surrender to me can easily cross beyond prapadyante. And then he talks about the classes of people who na prapadyante, don't surrender. Right away, they don't cross beyond material nature. And these are the ones, Duskritina, Mudha, Naradama, and Mayaya Apakritagyan. They are described in detail. There's a very long purport where we can find ourselves in the right category of Duskritina. So notice the word, the Duskriti, those who do bad. And then text 16, the Sukriti. Dukriti, Sukriti. Evildoers and doers of good. The Sukriti, who approach Krishna, even though, as we see, they are do not come for the most detached sorts of reasons. They are artha, the distressed, seekers of wealth, the inquisitive, and actually one who is searching for knowledge. So then he finally says of all of these, but the one who's coming the closest to him and to whom he favors the most is the one who's actually seeking of knowledge of me. And then he described that person who is embarking. This person is a transcendentalist. The search for knowledge ultimately leads to becoming a transcendentalist. And although this person may be first, well, if you're seeking for knowledge, and not power and not wealth, and all, so your research has a genuine desire of knowledge, you will eventually encounter some form of the impersonal Brahman, because you will come to the point where your materially contaminated senses can go no further. You've hit the border, and it says that's it, you can't go anymore. But you know there's something out there. It's fascinating, attractive. It's totally unknowable. It's attractive and sacred. And this is you. And you see this everywhere, and so many You see, these atomic physicists, early atomic physicists, Schrödinger, Oppenheimer, they started reading the Upanishads like crazy because they had encountered the border. They've seen that we can't go any further, but there's something out there that's big and important. And now if this person becomes successful in the knowledge, we come to the text 19. This search for knowledge, bahunam janmanam ante, it will take many births because it's difficult. And one becomes gyanavan. Gyanavan means one who actually possesses knowledge. What does he do? Mam prapadyate, same word, surrender. Here it's a singular, prapadyante is a plural. He surrenders to me. Vasudeva sarvam iti. Iti is like the quotation marks. He says or thinks, Vasudeva sarvam. Vasudeva is everything. There's two ways to understand this. Both are correct. One, that there's nothing but Krishna. And the other thing is, there's nothing for me but Krishna. Krishna is everything for me. And this is called a mahatma, a word also that starts to be a person that gets described in this chapter. Not just your ordinary street corner mahatma, but a sudurlabha, rarely found mahatma. I remember this one time, this Guru Maharaji was going through America, you know, the boy yogi. And he had a big festival in Houston, Texas. They rented the Astrodome, and he was going to make some big revelation. And so, in those days, this is what, 73 or something like that. And our congregation became, all kinds of people got attracted by this. We had this difficult process of Krishna consciousness, but they had a process that all one of their guys had to do was pinch you like this, and you saw a flash of light, and you got the knowledge. That was the knowledge.
I'm switching.
Huh? So that's what happened. So we had a devotee in our temple. He was a devotee, and his brother followed the Guru Maharaji. So this devotee's mother, Mrs. Strayhorn, went down to Houston, to the Astrodome, to this big festival. And she reported to me later what happened. She said to me, Rabinda, I have one son who loves Srila Prabhupada, and I have another son who loves Guru Maharaji. So then she says that she was down in Houston, and people were trying to take her to the Mahatma, because the name Mahatma was the guy who could do the thing and give you the knowledge. And so she told me, Rabindra, they're always telling me, go to the Mahatma and get the knowledge. So finally I went to see the Mahatma. And I said to him, Mahatma? I said to the Mahatma, Mahatma? I have one son that follows Srila Prabhupada. And I have another son that follows the Guru Maharaji. She said, but me? She says, I follow the Lord Jesus Christ. And Rabindra, I said to the Mahatma, I said, Mahatma, I already have that knowledge. And I said, Mrs. Strayhorn, I believe you when you say that. So there's another kind of Mahatma. I thought that was one of the great lines of the 70s, you know. So I said to the Mahatma, I said, Mahatma? I already have that. So here's the Sudurlabha Mahatma, the rare Mahatma. So this person, who actually, this is an important verse. People say they're practicing jnana or jnana yogis or so on. Okay, if you're successful. Krishna says the sign of your success is mam prapajyate. He surrenders to me. That's the sign. Your knowledge has now, because the word is jnanavan. You actually have jnana. So then, now this verse is beginning with 19 on down. This is very good to notice this, because I've had great success with this verse, especially with congregations of a lot of Indian people, because this shows that Krishna is not a Hindu. It's very clear. Because now he's discussed the Jnanavan and the result of Gandhi surrenders to Krishna. So now we come to another group of people. These are not described as the demons or the Maya upper and so on. They're not necessarily Duskriti, but still they don't surrender to Krishna. Here's this text 20, the same word, but papajyante, it's in the plural. They surrender, anya devataha. They surrender to other gods. They don't surrender to me. This refers to the demigods in this context. They refer to, why? Kamastai style hitta jnana. Their jnana has been taken away. The others has jnanavan, but these are opposite. They're stupid. And because they're stupid, because their knowledge has been removed because of various kinds of desires, material desires. So that's made them stupid. People have to know this. The sense gratification makes you stupid. It's stupefying. This is the big block in the search for knowledge. It lowers your IQ. My many points. You see, otherwise intelligent people do stupid things. You wonder why? Kamai stai stai ritta jnana. It never fails. So this is what they do. They surrender to other gods. So they're described as stupid, ritta jnana. Now, then Krishna goes on this little side, what about those people? It's not that they're completely gone, but rather Krishna works in a very subtle way. First of all, they describe what they don't see. They don't see that I give the Shraddha, as the super soul and the heart, I give them the Shraddha by which that person can worship that Devata and devote himself. So even though he's not worshiping me, he nevertheless, his ability to carry out that worship is given by me. Worship successfully, because it also takes a Shraddha. And because of that successful worship, he gets what he wants. But again, he doesn't actually get it from whoever he's worshiping. He gets it from me. I'm the one who actually bestows the benediction, because the devatas are dependent on Krishna. So they have to go up to the supplier and say, you know, let me pass it on down. So it comes from Krishna. So on the side of the worshipper, Krishna is actually what's making it possible for him to worship. And the side of the Devata, Krishna is actually making it possible for him to be a Devata. So the implication is that one should come directly to Krishna, even if you want something material. But people don't, because they're afraid, because Krishna, we know what Krishna does. You're a little afraid of... And this theme, as we can know, will be taken up again in the ninth chapter and developed a little further. Here again, he calls in text 23, he calls these people stupid. Not Hrithigyana, but Alpa Medasam. They have meager intelligence. Why is their intelligence meager? Because what they get for all their effort is limited and temporary fruit, antavat. The phalam they get comes to an end. In other words, for the same amount of effort, you could get something eternal. Why get something temporary? That's not very bright. And then he says, those who worship the devas go to the devas, but my devotee comes to me. They have different destinations. They don't all do the same place, as is often described. Neither is all worship equal. Huh? So that's one group of people who don't have jnana. The devatas, the worshippers of the devatas. Now, text 24, another class of stupid people. These are called here abudayaha, those who have no buddhi. This is the others are the worshippers of the devatas. These are the mayavadis, because they think manyante mam abudaya, those who are stupid, who have no intelligence. This is what they think about me. They think that first I was avyakta, without any name, form, quality, or activities, unmanifest. That I was avyakta, and then I attained or acquired or achieved vyakta, personality or form. There's a famous... Muktinanda, actually, he describes in a book how he saw Krishna. Krishna appeared to him. He saw a blue light, a formless blue light, and then the precipitated out of the formless blue light, Krishna holding a flute, who then looked at him and wiggled his eyebrows or something like that, and then was sucked up again into the formless blue light. This is what's described here as a buddhi. If you think that's what Krishna's like, then he says that you don't understand. My spiritual nature, my higher nature, which is imperishable and supreme. So that really, from the beginning, one who's actually a jnani, what it means to be a jnani, you surrender to Krishna. So you may call yourself a jnani, and have this theory, the Mayavad theory, that Krishna originally is unmanifest, and then somehow or other he acquires a material body or something like that, a personality that's temporary, and then he gives it up again, that you still don't understand who Krishna is. This is another form of stupidity. Then he sums this up. I am never manifest to the foolish and unintelligent. I'm covered by my yoga maya. Again, the word is strong language here, mudha, to the foolish. Therefore, they don't know me, who am unborn and infallible. And then Krishna says, when he says, I know everything that happened, past, present, and future, this means he's not subject to birth and death in the material world. as someone who knows. He knows all living entities, but he says, me, no one knows. Except, of course, the person who understands this chapter, the Bhagavad Gita. But otherwise, and again, now again, he comes to this famous, text 27. This is a kind of a summary of ignorance here, of who Krishna is, and how people don't know him. The ignorant. And then why are people ignorant? Because each adresa samukhena dvandamohena bharataha sarabhutani sammoham sarge yanti parantapaha. Sarga means creation. So while coming into this world, they come into a delusion, which is composed of icha and dvesha, desire and hate. I once had some kind of psychology course somewhere where the professor put an oval on the board, and he said this oval represents any organism. So it's a very general proposition. Inside the oval, he drew an arrow, one pointing to the right and one pointing to the left, and he labeled one approach and the other avoidance. And he said, this is the push-pull mechanism of every organism, to go toward that which keeps it alive or satisfies its senses, and to avoid those things which endanger it or threaten it. There it is, desire and hate, every living entity. When I read this, I thought of that. I forgot everything else in that course, but that I remembered. Huh? So it's true. Icha and dvesha, the push-pull mechanism, approach and avoidance, in that fellow's language, they're all covered like this. Due to desire and hate, the ignorant person wants to become one with the Supreme Lord and envies Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, the desire is, why can't I be God? This is the original desire. Why can't I be God? And the original hate is, why should Krishna be God? So that's what we got to get free from. Becoming Krishna's competitor. Huh? So this is this dvanda mohena, covered by this, by dvanda moha, the delusion, delusion of duality, this desire and hate. The next verse, 28, describes those who are dvanda moha niramukta, free from the duality. That's the third line here, dvanda moha niramukta. Those who are free from this duality. So you see these two verses go together. Those who are free from this duality, whose activities are pious, who have freed from all sins, bhajante mam, they worship me, duddhavata, with steady determination or a fixed vow. So here the devotees again come in here, those who are duddhavata, able to worship Krishna. And then in chapter the last two verses, that these persons who are devotees, who have taken shelter of me, ashrita, mam ashrita. Because they're desiring, endeavoring for liberation from old age and death. Now, these are the things they know. Now, this is also a little bit controversial, because what the Sanskrit says is that these are the things they know. They know what is Brahman. They know everything. What is Brahman? What is the Adhyatma? What is the nature of the soul? What is karma? These three things they know. The way Prabhupada translates it here, they know everything about transcendental activities. He says, adhyatma karma. He takes the juxtaposition of these two words to say that they know about transcendental activities. But the most straightforward meaning of the Sanskrit is there's an enumeration of things that they know. Because eighth chapter begins, Arjuna says, what is Brahman? What is Brahma? What is Adhyatma? What is karma? And of course it continues the other things that these people know and thoroughly. They know the Adibhuta, Adidaiva, and Adiyajna. And they know, and they can understand me at the time of death. And this sets it up for the whole next chapter. He says, Arjuna says these things. What is Brahman? What is karma? What is the nature of the soul? Who is the Lord of sacrifice? What are the living entities? And how can we know you at the time of death? And then that next chapter explains this. When Jayadwaita was translating this, when he saw how Prabhupada did it very differently, he was very tempted to change it. But as he said, well, Prabhupada wanted to make a preaching point. But there's another thing. If you look how commentators work, sometimes the juxtaposition of two words, even though the grammatical relationship may not, the grammar may not put them in a certain relationship. Nevertheless, the juxtaposition of two words is considered significant. And so that there's a hint here of the nature of transcendental activities. I'm sure this is what Prabhupada's understanding. And I, without knowing it, I would suspect that some commentator has pointed this out. Because I've read enough commentators to know how that they take a verse and find so many meanings in it. And sometimes it's just because two words are juxtaposed next to each other. But here these things are all listed. One's not an adjective and one's not a noun. They're both nouns listed together, but nevertheless the juxtaposition is considered significant as hinting or suggesting subtly about something, and Prabhupada took the subtle meaning. I've seen other places where Prabhupada has translated this verse or referred to it in lectures when he says exactly the way the most straightforward translation is. But it confuses people because when you notice, when you go to the next chapter, Arjuna says, what is Brahman? What is the self? What are fruitive activities? What is the material manifestation? What are the demigods? And so on. He asks basically for the meaning of each one of these words. And Krishna supplies it. And then goes on to talk about the rest of the chapter, how you can know me at the time of death. Okay. That brings us into that chapter. Any questions? Yeah. Another short ride in a fast machine.
verse 24, what you're reading about Mayavadi. When the Mayavadis read this verse, though, how do they translate?
You have to look it up. I don't remember anymore. At one point, I looked at a few of them. They have ways of doing things. Garuda told me that he was, when he was studying at the University of Chicago, in a Sanskrit class, that was reading the Bhagavad Gita. I forgot who the professor was. He was a famous professor. They came to this verse, the professor actually looked at all different translations, including the Mayavadi translations, and said they are all wrong. This was not a devotee professor, but he just said the clear, simple, straightforward meaning of the text is that if you think I was unmanifest and then became manifest later on, you're stupid. He says it's very plain, very simple, very easy to understand. And he saw how people translated it in various ways and twisted around. So Guru was impressed because he was a Sanskrit professor at the University of Chicago who came up with this clear understanding of the verse. Yeah?
If you look at Winthrop Sargent's translation of it, what he does is in parentheses, in the beginning of the verse, he says, though. And it changes the whole meaning because then he kind of switches it around and says, though unmanifest, I have taken.
But they do all kinds of things. The one I spent a lot of time trying to figure out was when Brahmano hi pratishtaham, how Shankaracharya got around that one. That one I looked at. And he does a very clever thing by ignoring the context. The beginning of that chapter, the three modes of material nature, and the beginning of that chapter, Brahma is defined as the total material nature. So, Brahmano hi pratishtaham simply means, yeah, I am. I am the basis of support of the total material nature. Right? But if you look at the verse before, what's the verse before that one? Brahmano hi pratishtaham. Anybody remember? Well, I'll have to go look it up. Chapter 14. Yeah, what is that verse? How does it go? Mam chayo vyabhacharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samiti chaitat brahma bhuyaya kalpate. There it ends with, those who go beyond the modes of material nature, they attain Brahman. Brahmano hi pratishtaham. So the word Brahman is used in the verse before, meaning that which is beyond the total material nature. And then Krishna says, then I am the basis of that Brahman. So he ignores the word Brahman as it appears in the verse before and goes back to the beginning of the chapter to import that meaning of the word Brahman to suit his purposes. Yeah.
Yeah, I have this question when Krishna talks about the four types of people that don't surrender.
Yeah.
And at the last he says a Maya Paritarthi and one who's knowledge is stolen. Mm-hmm. Are this, you know, Maya Paritarthi not the people that knowledge is being stolen by illusion?
Well, some. I don't think Prabhupada is. Let me look and see what he says here. Sorry about this. We have to say that there's two kinds of impersonalists. Prabhupada said that if you don't understand Krishna, you haven't heard about Krishna yet, there's no harm in being an impersonalist. So there are the impersonalists that we generally call Brahmavadis. They're attracted to the impersonal Brahman, but they do not come out with a theory that Krishna is material, or that Krishna is a product of material nature. They're just attracted to the impersonal Brahman. They don't therefore commit any offense against Krishna, and should they encounter Krishna, like the four Kumaras, or like Sukadeva Goswami, they are attracted to Krishna, because his qualities and so on are not material. They're not attracted to anything material, but they become attracted to Krishna. So that's the Brahmavadis. The Mayavadis are a little different kind of impersonalists. They have the theory that Krishna is made of Maya. That's why they're called Mayavadis. So the Brahmavadis and the Mayavadis. And the Mayavadis are offenders and people whose knowledge is stolen by illusion. And sometimes they're big competitors with Krishna. It's their other way of getting close to Krishna, to kill him. Neti, neti, neti. Chop him up. Take his place. So that's different. But the Brahmavadis are those that they're seriously searching for knowledge, and when it finally leads them to Krishna, then they accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of God, and they have nothing against Him. Okay? Yeah?
In Sanskrit language, there is no like rules for the words in order. Like, we can quote Vasudeva Sarva and Sarvam Vasudeva. That's two remains.
Yeah, word order doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, word order doesn't matter. Yeah. So some philanthropists take that liberation and they think that Sarvam Vasudeva and everything is Vasudeva. If you serve everybody, then you're serving God. And they put that the. So how do we counter that?
Well, because in this chapter, Krishna makes a very big distinction all the time about how He's the source of everything, and though if he says, "I am the light of the sun and the moon," if you simply worship light as God, you become a pantheist, or you become a nature worshiper. How should we worship light? Here is the light coming from Krishna. All throughout this chapter, if you look at the whole context of the thing, Krishna is really teaching us what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describes as Achincha Bheda Bheda Tattva. And people get really confused by this. We will see in the ninth chapter, people talk about these people. They worship everything as God. They worship themselves as God, they worship everything as God, and they worship the cosmic organism as God. But they are described as others. They're not Mahatmas. Again, you can misinterpret that. Because other people say, other Mahatmas. But if you look at the whole context, Krishna is teaching a very careful way of to see how, while nothing is different from Krishna, Krishna is different from everything. So I cannot say that, you know, this Dharidra Narayan philosophy, which was concocted by the Vivekananda, in order to compete with Christian charities. I mean, here's people that believe the real understanding of Shankaracharya is the material world and everything in it and all material pious and impious activities are so devalued, devalorized, that they're absolutely and totally worthless because the material world has no standing in reality. It's not there. That's what it really teaches. It's actually Mayavada philosophy. The real meaning of Mayavada philosophy is to deny that the absolute truth has energies. This is Shankaracharya's clear teaching. The absolute truth has no energies. Well, how do we see this world around here? Well, it's ignorance. It's not the energies of Krishna. It's just ignorance. Where does that ignorance come from? We don't worry about that. It's just there. It's just sort of floating around. It cannot be spoken of as existing, and it cannot be spoken of as not existing, they say. In other words, when they need it, it's there. When they don't need it, it's gone. It's like a useful device, because they got this thing. Because really, from the point of view of Shankaracharya, the world simply shouldn't be here. Neither should you be a student, neither should he be a teacher, neither should the text teach you anything, because it's all Maya. So, but anyway, that's his clear teaching. So if you just turn your whole back on the world. So this makes it very hard to compete with Christian missionaries who go out feeding the poor and the hungry and everything. So you've been another philosophy to make that possible, make you seem humanistic. Yeah.
This whole chapter on the topic of knowledge, in this verse 19, Krishna says, develop this knowledge, there's so many words that surrender to me. So in Nectar Devotion, when I'm studying Jnana-Dharma-Navritam, real devotion doesn't involve knowledge. So how do you reconcile that context with this?
Well, you have to understand in the context. The clear explanation that's given of knowledge in that thing is it's an extraneous. In other words, jnana here means the endeavor for salvation or becoming one with God. So if you're pursuing knowledge, you will come to Krishna. However, forget it and just come directly to Krishna. The knowledge will be an automatic byproduct. That's what we find out at the end of the Bhagavad Gita. You can drop the whole thing. You don't have to try. You just come directly to Krishna. It's even in the four essential verses, when Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tam, Prabhupada could say, even if you're really stupid and you can't read the books and you don't listen to your spiritual mind, but somehow you're sincere and serious, I'll give you the brains you need. So actually, if there's bhakti, jnana and vairagya come in the train. So you really don't need it. But for those who are on the path of knowledge, great. This is where you, if you actually succeed, this is where you will go. But then it's not your goal anymore. You have something better, which actually includes jnana in it and everything else. Vairagya, all these things. Okay? Well, generally in that verse, Anya Abhilasita Sunyam, Jnana Karma Adi, etc. Jnana, Karma, Siddhi, whatever extraneous thing other than love of Krishna you're after, then it's an anartha. So you become free from these extraneous things. Ulterior motives, Abhilasita. That you're serving Krishna. Ultimately, we should serve Krishna because our goal is love of God. And don't think that you'll be losing out anywhere, that you'll somehow miss out on jnana or karma or whatever else. Because one should have this in the beginning, adho shraddha. First of all, there should be confidence. And Chait Mahaprabhu defines Shraddha as the firm conviction that if I attain Krishna consciousness, automatically all other things, the yoga shema, will be provided for me. Maybe we should get going. Aren't we supposed to end what time? 10:30 or something like that? Yeah, so we better move on, huh? We got the whole ninth chapter. Do you want it to break? Can we go a little late? I mean, maybe people have been sitting for a long time.
Do you want to take a break? We'll go to take a 5-minute break?
Yeah, and then go through to 11. That's better. Huh? Okay, let's take a 5-minute break. Huh? Good to see you, Haribo. Turn off this machine.